I can't fix my disease, so I'm going to focus on creating health. And I accidentally fixed my disease, but that was never my intention because I knew it couldn't happen.
Welcome to Better with Dr. Stephanie. I am your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. This show is for women just like you with a deep desire for learning, self-actualization, and becoming more of who you already are. Every week, we are going to deconstruct how to build better bodies, better minds, better relationships, better sex, and better families. I'll be giving you access to world-class thought leaders to help give you the tools to answer this question. What are the simplest things that you can do today to get better tomorrow? I am part geek, part magic, and want to share the juiciest questions, topics, and often taboo conversations that I think I've always wanted to be a part of and I wanted to be having. So let's get better together. Hey, Betties, welcome back to Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Walls, an autoimmune warrior, if there ever was one. Dr. Terry Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, where she conducts several clinical trials looking at autoimmunity, specifically multiple sclerosis, but many others. She's also a patient with secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, which confined her to a tilt-reclined zero-gravity wheelchair for 4 years. Dr. Walls restored her health using diet and lifestyle that she designed specifically for her brain, and now she pedals her bike to work each day. She's the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine, as well as The Walls Protocol, A Radical New Way to Treat All Chronic Autoimmune Conditions Using Paleo Principles, as well as the accompanying cookbook. Dr. Walls conducts clinical trials that test the efficacy of nutrition and lifestyle interventions to treat MS and other progressive health issues. Now, if you are a woman, if you are a woman or a man who knows someone who's been affected by an autoimmune disease, this podcast is a must listen to. Terry starts off in our conversation detailing her story, which is absolutely nothing short of miraculous, where she started having some of these weird symptoms that eventually progressed to her being in a wheelchair. We talk about the research that she is currently doing. And if you listen to the end of our conversation, if you are interested in enrolling in her next clinical trial, it is now in the next couple of weeks from when this podcast is published, will be open for enrollment. So we'll have all the links and the details for you in the show notes. We talk about her going from kind of like a, you know, we call it a tinfoil hat heretic, talking about working on lifestyle and diet modifications to being hailed as a visionary luminary in the space. We talk about what autoimmunity is, what an autoimmune disease encompasses. We talk about mitochondria and purinergic signaling and the cell defense and some of the potent roles that the mitochondria have in our immune response. We talk about metabolomics and how dysregulated blood sugar and insulin can also alter the progression of multiple sclerosis. We talk about the carnivore diet. We talk about sulforaphanes and the brassica genus, fasting, the ketogenic diet, hormesis, all of these things around helping to improve autoimmune symptoms. And then finally, we talk about the microbiome and the gut, the role of the gut and its role in autoimmunity. I think this is a wonderful conversation, as I mentioned. Please forward this to somebody that you think might benefit. And if you're finding the podcast useful in any way, a rating or a review, pretty please with a cherry on top. All right. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Terry Walls. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Bond Charge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Bond Charge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure, and that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to bondcharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week, per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com. Dr. Terry Walls, we are live and I am so thrilled and honored to welcome you to the Better with Dr. Stephanie podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I reached out to you because your story is, well, it's nothing short of inspiring and hopeful. Some might call it miraculous. And I think hopefully in our discussion, we'll take away the sort of the magic part of it and like talk more about the signs of why, you know, why, where you are today. And for my listeners who are not familiar with your story, I think that might be a nice anchoring point. We're going to be talking all about autoimmunity today. We're going to have a focus on multiple sclerosis, but there's going to be sort of a broader conversation around the disease state of autoimmunity. So let's start with, I think before your diagnosis is more appropriate, when you first started noticing some of the apparent, you know, the aberrant symptoms, like weird stuff that was like, man, this doesn't seem like, no, like what did that look like? And how many years, passed between that and your diagnosis?
We're going to give you a really intimate look at what I experienced. So, 20 years ago, I'm, you know, still athletic. I'm out walking with my wife and my left leg becomes weak. You know, and I drag it, hobble home, see the neurologist. And he says, you know, Terry, this could be bad or really, really bad. So at night while I'm going through the workup for the next 3 weeks, I'm thinking about the fact that I've had already 20 years of a progressive worsening of electrical face pain due to trigeminal neuralgia. So I'm thinking, okay, you've got a progressive disease. You don't want to be disabled. I'm praying for a rapidly fatal. 3 weeks later, I hear multiple sclerosis. And, you know, and again, I'm a physician, academic physician. So I seek out the best MS center in the country, start the newest drugs, and continue to decline. Now, interestingly, my physician tells me about the paleo diet, work of Lauren Cardain, and after having been a low-fat vegetarian for about 20 years, I go back to eating meat. The next year, I need a tilt-recline wheelchair. We get even more aggressive with my treatments. I take mitoxantrone, does not help. I take Tysabri, you know, the new biologic that, you know, is supposed to turn off relapses by 70%. Does not help. I've switched to CellCept. And that's when I go back to reading the basic science, because I had been reading the literature. And it was just getting me upset when I was first diagnosed. And my wife said, Terry, you got to stop. Reading is just getting you upset. We'll find you the very best people. So I'm reading basic science, and I, in that reading, decide that mitochondria are key. I create a supplement cocktail to support my mitochondria. And after 6 months, decide, you know, I'm wasting my money and stop. But I discover that once I stop, I feel even worse, can't get out of bed. And 3 days later, my Jackie comes in and says, yeah, honey, why'd you take these again? So I start them the next day.
What was
I feel it?
Can I interrupt you for a moment? What was in the supplement cocktail?
So it was carnitine, creatine, CoQ, and a B complex.
Okay.
And so I'm feeling better and I can go to work and I think, wow, that was really interesting. So a couple weeks later, I do the experiment again. Wait 3 days. I'm flat out exhausted, cannot get out of bed. And I think, wow, this is really interesting. So now I'm much more excited about reading the basic science and tinkering with what I'm doing. I gradually add more supplements. I then discover a study using electrical stimulation of muscles. And I ask my physical therapist, and we add that. He calls it E-STIM. Mm-hmm. My test session hurts really bad, but I feel incredible afterwards. And plus, he stimulates various muscles in my back, then in my quads. So I've done a half hour of electrically driven exercise. And without the E-STIM, I could only do 10 minutes without being flat out exhausted. So that in itself was interesting. And the euphoria was interesting. My physical therapist said, you know, Terry, it's the E-STIM. It's the endorphins. So for 2 weeks, I come back and I do E-STIM in the clinic, sort of an E-STIM augmented exercise program. At the end of 2 weeks, it says, okay, I've done some research. I found a home-going E-STIM device, and I start doing E-STIM at home with a little 10-minute exercise routine that I can do once a day, because if I do more, I'm too exhausted to go to work. At the same time, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. I take their course on neuroprotection, which was tricky because I was beginning to have some brain fog, but I slog my way through. I have more supplements, which I've added. And then I have this really big aha. What if I redesign my paleo diet based on now focusing on the nutrients I should get and figuring out where they are in the food supply? So now I've created this list of all these foods that I should be eating based on the nutrients that the research that I've read said are really vital for mitochondria. And I start this new way of eating December 26, 2007. Now, at that point, I want to paint a picture for your audience. I'm too weak to sit up in a regular chair. I have a zero gravity chair where I lean back with my knees higher than my nose. I have one at home, one at work. My university, the VA, the hospital where I work, has redesigned my job multiple times so I could keep working. My trigeminal neuralgia has been getting progressively more severe, more frequent, much more difficult to turn off. So the future I see very clearly is bedridden, demented, intractable pain, where light, sound, a breeze triggers the pain, talking triggers the pain, swallowing triggers the pain. So what I'm doing is to slow my decline, because all of my physicians, for the 7 years that I've had MS and the 4 years I've had secondary progressive MS, have said functions once lost, Terry, will never come back. So I understand, we're not coming back. I just want to slow it down as slow as I can. So I've redesigned my paleo diet. I have more supplements. I'm doing more E-STIM. And my boss, and I think rightfully so, he had reassigned me to a new job where I'd be staffing the traumatic brain injury clinic as part of a multidisciplinary team. I'd be seeing patients without residents. As he described the job to me in June, I knew there's no way I could physically do the job. But I was starting that job in January. So I was going to be starting that new role in a couple of weeks. So, you know, January comes around. I go the first 2 weeks, I'm just going to watch my new partners do their assessments. So on the third week, so it's the fourth week of this new way of eating. Now I'm examining these folks. I'm getting up out of my wheelchair, doing the exam, sitting back down. And at the end of the day, I think, well, that went better than I thought. And then at the end of the week, the first week, I'm like, well, that definitely went better than I thought. And at the end of January, I'm like, I think I can do this. And, you know, my energy is better.
From 6 months earlier, thinking, I'm going to have to go on disability, can't do this, started eating this way December 26th. And then by the end of the following month.
End of January.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, my fatigue is less. My mental clarity is definitely more. And, you know, my face is feeling better. And then in February, my physical therapist says, Terry, you're stronger. We're going to advance your exercises. Because I'm seeing my physical therapist about once a month. And so we're advancing my exercises. It has me beginning to lift weights. Yeah, small weights, mind you, but you know, I'm lifting weights. In March, actually, it's probably in February, later February, I have my walking sticks in my office and I mail a letter. I walk down the hall, and mail a letter. People see me walking. They're like, oh my God, Dr. Wallace, you're walking. Spring, I'm beginning to walk around the block. So I'm now walking around the block. And mind you, when you have a secondary progressive MS, you're in a wheelchair, and everyone's been telling you that functions once lost don't come back. One of the adaptive things you do is you learn to take each day as it unfolds, and you let go of the future. So I've made remarkable progress. I'm walking around my little hospital. I walk around the block. It's probably a half mile with Jack. But I'm still living day by day because I don't know what any of this means because functions once lost do not come back. And I asked Jack, do you think I could start biking again? He just says, well, if things keep going well, maybe we can try in the fall. Well, 2 weeks later, it's Mother's Day, and it's a beautiful spring day, and I want to try riding my bike. So we have an emergency family meeting, Jackie, my children who are in high school.
When is Mother's Day? Is that April?
It's May. It was May 8th.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. May 8th. So Jack says we can try. We get the bike in position. I'm at the curb. Zach, my son's going to run on the left side. Zebby will run on the right side. She'll follow me in the bike. And I push off. And I bike around the block. My son is crying. My daughter's crying. Jackie's crying. I'm crying. And of course, as I tell that story, I cry again. Because that was the moment where I understood the current understanding of multiple sclerosis was incomplete. That who knew how much recovery might be possible. So, every day I go bike a little bit further. I'm doing, more weights. I'm doing more e-stim. And then that October, there's a courage ride. Jack and I decided to sign up for it. It's 18.5 miles. And we figure, however far I go, will be miraculous.
Is a win. Yeah. You've already won.
Right. However far I go will be fine. And the furthest that I've biked at that point was 8 miles. So I bike 5 miles, I lay down on the grass, take a rest. I bike another 5 miles, take a rest. And so I had 3 rests, but I made 18.5 miles. So once again, we're all crying. You know, my son's crying. You know, my kids are crying. Jackie's crying. I'm crying. And how I understand disease and health is completely transformed. How I approach healthcare in my clinics, in the traumatic brain injury clinic, and in my primary care clinic is completely transformed. And my chief of medicine at the university, who sees me, you know, every couple of years for my, you know, every 2 year review with how everything's going. When I walk in, you know, the last time he saw me, you know, I was in a tilt recline wheelchair looking really pretty terrible. And I walk in, he's like, "Oh my God, are you on Tysabri?" And I said, no, I'm on no disease modifying drugs anymore. I haven't been on anything. And I showed him my eSTIM device, talked about what had happened. He's a rheumatologist. And he says, "We have to get a case report written up, Terry. That's your assignment this year." And then once I do that, he calls me back and says, "And now your assignment is you're changing your research. I'll get you the mentors. We're going to have you do a safety and feasibility, see if other people with progressive MS can implement the complicated thing that you did. And if they do, what happens?" And of course, that changes the direction of my clinical practice, the direction of my clinical research, and really the direction of my life in a really big way. He encourages me to begin talking to the public about what I'm doing with local organic grocers. Now, mind you, at the same time, there are the people at the university and the VA who were very upset with what I was doing and how I'd transformed my clinical practice. And so, fortunately, Dr. Rothman became dean of the College of Medicine. So I survived all this, but I took intense criticism at the VA and at the university for what
was the criticism? What was the criticism?
Well, so I got called in to the chief of staff's office, who said, "Terry, people are complaining that you are not practicing the standard of care, and they're very upset."
The patients are complaining?
No. It was my clinical partners. And so I brought with me an armful of scientific papers. I went through them. In the end, John said, "Okay, if you hurt anyone, you'll go through peer review just like we would anyone else." I said, "Yeah, of course, I understand that. But we have to send you to the university's complementary alternative medicine clinic so you know how to talk about what you're doing when you're giving public talks and in the medical record. Because you could have an anonymous complaint on your license that will have to be investigated, probably by people who don't believe in integrative and functional medicine." Mm-hmm. So I want you to learn how to talk about this more carefully, more appropriately, so you're not getting people upset and you're not putting your license at risk. So I, you know, and actually I was like, okay, this sounds pretty serious. So I did go meet with the head of the complementary alternative medicine clinic. And then I was very, very careful to always focus on, I am working on creating health, improving your physiology. This is an alternative approach to how you address your current symptoms and your chronic disease state. And if you want management, traditional management for your, that's FDA approved, we'll offer that to you. But if you want this alternative diet and lifestyle approach, that's what I'm offering. And as always, once I made that change in my clinical notes, my partners were much more comfortable. And I was always very, very careful in my public presentations. And then as my reputation grew and grew, you know, I practically have to check in with my chair at the university to be sure that I was messaging in a way that would not create ire with the FDA.
Right. And sometimes when you present a compelling case like yours, right, where yep. you have this severe progression of a disease, in 3 weeks you're in a wheelchair, you have zero gravity, chairs, you're having difficulty, getting up and walking around. I think that when you say, you know what, I modified my lifestyle factors, I changed my diet, like you can almost hear the hard eye rolls from like these valiant defenders of mm-hmm. sort of the traditional medical establishment. Like, it's like, there's no evidence to support that. And
the university kept getting calls from people saying, you made a incorrect diagnosis. She could not possibly have had multiple sclerosis. And so they were like, so glad I'd gone to these international MS centers so they could say, well, this is, in fact, it's been validated by multiple centers. So my university, my neurologist, my neurology department have been vigorously attacked for what I've had to say because I was creating false hope, and they were incompetent because I surely never had multiple sclerosis. And then when we do all these clinical trials, so I've done four prospective clinical trials, all of which have shown people can implement the concepts I talk about, and that we're able to show clinically significant, statistically significant improvement in several domains. So it's not just me. We have peer-reviewed published results. We have, I have tens of, hundreds of thousands of followers who are telling us that they've used these concepts for their complex chronic diseases, many of which I've had to look up because I've not heard of before. And they've had improvement with stabilization of their progressive disease and often with regression of their progressive disease, and that they have improved quality of life, reduced pain, and better function.
Right. And I think that, I think what's important to highlight here is that all evidence starts with a case study, right? In this case, it's woman telling her story, and we say, okay, let's investigate to see if this signal is strong enough, not just with her, Terry's story, let's say, but we do a series and see if there's any signal there. And then we progress to higher and higher levels of investigation and, control, let's say, in the variables. Yes. And I think that...
That is so true. We did a case report. Then my chair said, we'll do a case series. We did that. Mm-hmm. Then he said, you do a safety and feasibility study. So it's a single arm. You see, can people do it? Because what I did was very complicated. Did we hurt anyone? The biggest harm was if you're overweight, you lost weight. And what was the effect size? And the effect size turned out to be really quite large for fatigue, quality of life. And with progressive MS, you expect a 10 to 20% worsening if anyone has any disability year by year. So if we held the group to a stable level of walking, that would be stunning and very unexpected, which mm-hmm. we did. But half of our folks had clinically meaningful improvements in either hand or walking function. Stunning, stunning. Because you wouldn't expect any of them to improve. And then we switched over. We started investigating relapse and remitting MS, and we did randomized controlled trials. So we've done three of those. We have two trials underway right now, and we have another one that we are soon to be screening for.
And what was the lag time, estimation in terms of like your case study to now today where you're running these RCTs? What is the sort of time lapse there?
The first study we started in 2010, and we got publication of the results in 2014. Then we got three small pilot randomized studies that happened in Those got published in 2017. We did the next larger study, a much larger randomized controlled trial, and that's been the largest dietary intervention study done for MS to date. And of course, that was a six-month intervention. We had a 12-week observation, 12-week intervention, 12-week follow-up. And it took us 4 years to get that study done. That got published July 2021. We have a couple studies that are going on now that we'll be analyzing probably this time next year in terms of analyzing the results. And so that will probably get published, depending on how, you know, it takes 6 months to a year to get, once you have your data analyzed, written up and published. So that'll probably get published in 2023. Doing research is definitely, in one sense, it feels like a sprint at the time because you're working so damn hard, getting the money and doing all that stuff. But it's also really an endurance sport. Because human clinical trials, it takes a while to recruit, to do the study, analyze, then write up the publication. The next study that we're going to do will take 5 years to conduct. You know, another 6 months to analyze, another 6 months to find somewhere to publish and get it. And so if we're starting now, it's 2028 that those findings will be out.
Yeah. And I ask that because it seems like there's like on average 4 to 5 years before a result can be put forward in a way that sort of satisfies some of these higher, we'll call them evidence-based critics. Right. And
that's the very earliest. And what they really wanted me to have before I could talk about my experience was double-blind placebo-controlled trials, which of course you can't really do with.
And you can't start with that. You can't start with that.
You can't start that. Case series, safety studies, single arm, small pilot studies, larger pilot studies, and then these bigger, multi-million dollar, 2 year long studies, which is what I'm doing now. And I should also say, the reason I'm able to do this stuff is my protocol has touched the lives of people who have economic means, who approached the university and said, we believe in Dr. Walls. We see you have a research foundation for her. We want to donate. So that allowed me to do those early pilot studies. And we received a major gift, which is allowing me to do the study that we will start screening, shortly. That's that 5-year study. Mm-hmm. In the MS Society, when they saw the traction my work was getting, they made diet research a priority. And they also knew that their constituents wanted an answer to the question, Walls or Swank, which is better? So we did that comparison study.
And I think I bring this up because I think if you had waited for 4 years, 5 years, 7 years for something to be, acclaimed by, your colleagues, you would have been, as you mentioned, demented and disabled. And, so I think it's important for us to maybe as clinicians, anyway, there's a lot of clinicians that listen to this show, for us to really take our patients' stories seriously and to maybe not disregard, because we always need research. This is not the point I'm trying to make, but I think that sometimes you can act on low level evidence, like a case series or a case study, especially when you can see it replicated over time. And I wanted to maybe move this conversation. First, I wanted to ask you, because I know that, you mentioned that maybe the consensus, which is often what happens in medicine, we have sort of consensus medicine in terms of like, mm-hmm. this is the established standards of practice. And we all adhere to this. We all say, I, and like, we all agree that this is the thing. And like, there's no deviation from it. And you sort of came in and said, well, I've been doing this electrical stim. I've been doing these studies. Taking these supplements. I've been, walking a little bit more, feeling a little bit better. My energy's better. I wanted to ask you how your, how people have, how your view or your appearance has changed over time. Because I was saying to you in the pre-chat, I think that you were probably looked at like a tinfoil hat, this heretic, crazy nut person, to now, you know, it's like, look at this brilliant visionary who's able to, you know, so I wanted you to maybe comment on that. And I know you were banned. Yeah. I know you were banned for a while.
As a band speaker, severely criticized.
Yeah.
A variety of people tried to stop my research. Fortunately, my chair had become the dean, so he made sure that that did not happen. Every year there is a research days for the Department of Internal Medicine, the College of Medicine, and we'd present our data.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount. That is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
When we're presenting the videos of the gait changes that we were achieving and the level of adherence to the dietary changes, the addition of the meditation, the exercise and the stem, people were amazed at one, the adherence, how we could radically change people's diets. They were amazed at the gait videos that we have remarkable improvements.
And what was changed in the gait? Was it proprioception, balance?
So
everything.
So needing a walker, still needing a walker, but now they could, it took them a minute and 43 seconds to do a get up and go, to get up, walk 8 feet, turn around, sit down. At the end of the year, it took her 42 seconds and she could comfortably swing her legs forward.
Nice.
One person, we had two individuals that needed walking sticks who were now faster without walking sticks. We had another individual who needed a cane, short distances, walker, long distances, who was now jogging. So you could see the decreased spasticity, the better balance, the smoothness of the gait, the increased speed. And you didn't have to be a statistician. You didn't have to be a scientist to be able to see these remarkable transformations. We were able to show that as a group, they were having a pretty standard American diet at baseline. 1.5 servings of vegetables, 5 servings of grain and dairy a day. And at the end of the study, no gluten, dairy, or eggs, the foods we excluded, and 8 cups of vegetables a day. Huge. That's a dramatic change in diet that was sustained. And from a public health standpoint, if you can get people to have 1 serving of vegetables more at the end of the year, that's like a home run. So we went from 1.5 to 8. And people were meditating 8 minutes a day on average. And people, these exhausted secondary progressive folks, were exercising every day. And after, I don't recall how many minutes we had on average at the end. I think it was 45 minutes. You know, really quite remarkable. The quality of life improvement, you know, in 5 is clinically meaningful. So we got 17.
Wow.
That's the largest quality of life improvement that's been reported yet in the most disabled group. Their fatigue severity scale score, a change of 0.45 is clinically meaningful. And we got a reduction of 2.38.
Incredible.
Then we measured anxiety and depression. Both of those went down. We measured verbal reasoning and nonverbal reasoning. Both of those improved. And so it is a remarkable transformation. And of course, you could say, well, that was a single arm group. It's not randomized. They got a lot of attention from your team, which they did, particularly the first 3 months, less so in the next 9 months. So then we started doing smaller randomized prospective pilot studies. And then we focused just on the diet. So you were either got the diet instruction immediately, or you had to wait 12 weeks to get the diet instruction. And again, we're able to show improved quality of life, reduced anxiety, reduced depression. It's interesting, better hand control that we could see, and better walking endurance. Then we did a study comparing a keto diet to the Walls diet to weightless control. And again, we can show, but it's a very small study. So we didn't reach statistical significance, but part of the problem is it's a very small study. But still, we could show both intervention arms had reduced fatigue, improved quality of life compared to the usual diet arm.
So the two arms being keto and the Walls protocol, and
correct,
then the control being nothing.
Usual diet.
Usual, yeah, just usual SAD. Usual. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's kind of dig in a little bit to the science. I think this is a really good segue. We've been talking about specifically multiple sclerosis, which is a degeneration of the central nervous system, the myelin sheath. For those of you that are listening, it's like the fatty covering that helps with conduction and nerve signaling. But one of the things that I find, and you mentioned this briefly, is that it's not just MS patients that are benefiting from this, that you're seeing like other autoimmune conditions, Hashimoto's, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and then things that you may or may not consider autoimmunity, depending on kind of what camp you're in, like, you know, FM, chronic pain, chronic fatigue. And I wanted to maybe dig in a little bit to the mitochondria. You have a very, we'll call it a viral TED talk. When I was in school, we learned that the mitochondria are these sort of like mindless, we call them the battery packs of the cell that just pump out ATP. But we now know that, of course, I was talking to you about this in the pre-chat, of course, through this purinergic signaling and cell defense response, that they have a profound role in immunity. And I wanted you to maybe expand a little bit on what your thinking is around the role of mitochondrial health and the progression of autoimmunity.
Well, it's really critical for the progression of many of our disease states, autoimmunity, cognitive decline, probably diabetes and heart disease as well. If you can't generate enough energy for the cell to function well, then all of the tasks assigned to that will deteriorate. You know, my original reading, you know, back in 2004 when I'm in the wheelchair, I'm reaching the conclusion that in my case, though I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS, I had much more of a progressive, slow decline. And as I'm reading about other progressive, slowly declining diseases, and all of them for MS, Huntington's, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lewy body dementias, the mitochondria were sending signals prematurely to die. And there's a lot of oxidative stress. Evidence that the mitochondria were not generating enough energy. So, hey, what are the drugs? And then I finally gave up on that. So then, you know, I'm starting to read what are the nutraceuticals and supplements that might be helpful. And as I learned more about mitochondria, and I'm appreciating that nutrition is key. A lot of our prescription medications deplete nutrients that are important for mitochondria. Makes you more likely to have mitochondrial insufficiency. If you have a lot of toxins, glyphosate, for example, a lot of the insecticides will impact some of the ability of the mitochondria to generate ATP through the Krebs cycle. And so I keep thinking like, okay, the mitochondria are really a key part of cellular biology for us. And it's probably a linchpin. So I was focused on what are the nutrients that I saw as most critical for effective mitochondrial function. As I got better at that, then I began thinking about, okay, so what does the synapse need? What do we need for myelin? So I began constructing my supplement regimen that way. And then when I had my aha, like, okay, if I think the paleo diet spends a lot of time on what not to eat and nowhere near enough time on what to eat. And so when I shifted my focus on, okay, I should be getting these nutrients from the food, and there are probably thousands of other compounds in the food that I bet will also be supportive to my cellular biology that we've never named, don't understand, don't really understand how they fit in. And so you know, when people get, I see so many folks get excited and say, okay, the paleo diet fixed walls, supplements fixed walls, E-stim fixed walls. No. It was when I made the shift to, I'm going to focus on maximizing health by getting to what are the foods I need to eat for those nutrients. Yes, I still took the supplements. I'm adding more exercise in E-stim. I'm going back to meditation, and I'm focused on, I can't fix my disease, so I'm going to focus on creating health. And I accidentally fixed my disease, but that was never my intention because I knew it couldn't happen.
I've had some people on the show, and this is sort of the point of the podcast, is I want to speak to a broad range of people with varying ideologies. And one of the individuals I've had on the show, I know you've been on his podcast, Dr. Paul Saladino, known as the Carnivore MD.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's great.
I've had, had some vigorous debates. And what
yes.
If, yes. So I think that they may have some really interesting insights. But I've spoken with Paul, and I said, Paul, write a case report, write a case series, invite my team to do a research with you. Because right now, I don't have any guidance as to who the right patients are, what needs to be monitored, what are the mechanisms by which your principles are so helpful. And you know what? We will help you. You can reach out. I've got medical students who would love to help write the case report in the case series. And so far, the various people I've spoken with in the carnivore community, and I keep making this offer, they've not been able to organize themselves to do this. And I can appreciate that. It is work. It's a lot of work to put together a case report in a case series. It's work to do research. If you don't know how to do these things, it feels very intimidating, which is part of why I've said, I have access to medical students and postdocs who want to be doing these things. And so we can help if you're willing to work with us. You know, and I'm not sure what the impediment has been. My team and I have been talking about this. We would really like to help them get some case reports and case series written up. I think it'd be very helpful.
I do too, because I with Paul, I probably agree 85 to 90% in terms of what he's saying. Like, we definitely need to be consuming organ meats. That I grew up having lots of organ meats, like the bone marrow, liverwurst, like liver and onions. Like, I, you know, my mom used to cut, you know, like chicken hearts. Yeah.
Every Friday we had that was what you'd have.
Right. And I think that that's really becoming more of a, we'll say, not a lost art, but a lot more children are not being exposed to organ meats. I think animal proteins are a superior source of the complete complement of amino acids than maybe long-term vegetarian or vegan sources of proteins.
It can be done. I mean, I want to acknowledge for those who are spiritually committed to that, yes, it can be done. But we need to help you do it clinically, safely to do it well.
Right.
I also want to note, I had to correct the carnivore folks on a couple of concepts. They were pushing liver very, very hard. And liver is a superfood. And the problem with eating lots of liver is you may develop excess vitamin A in your body. And excess vitamin A, like nearly all of our nutrients have a U shape.
This area.
Not enough.
Curve. Yeah.
Not enough. You're going to be diseased. Too much. You'll be diseased. So acute toxicity of vitamin A is really hard to do. Polar bear liver is one way of doing it.
Yes.
But chronic toxicity comes very slowly, and you can have fibrosis in the lungs, pulmonary fibrosis. You can have fibrosis in your liver, cirrhosis, and both are fatal, have to be treated with organ transplants. And once you get all that vitamin A in, you can't get it out. So, you know, 6 to 8 ounces of liver a week, plus lots of colorful vegetables, very good for you. A pound of liver every week, I think, puts a person at great risk for chronic vitamin A toxicity. I've conveyed that to the carnivore community when I have the opportunity to chat with them. And I'm hoping they're backing off of the 16 ounces a week, because I agree 16 ounces a week will not give you acute vitamin A toxicity. It will not. Over years,
correct,
you're at great risk for fibrosis of the liver, of the lungs, and potentially of the heart as well.
Well, this is parallel to the LDL argument, right? It's like, well, my LDLs are 400 and I'm fine. It's like, right, this year, but you have that for 30 years and we're going to have a problem, right? So it's like this sort of lifetime exposure that seems to be more important. And I think that's what you're saying. Like, you know, you have an acute consumption of liver, let's say, or, you know, whatever, not really going to do much. But that it's that chronic low grade exposure that's going to, and sort of getting to the other side of that AUC, that area under the curve, where I think we run into issues.
There's not enough recognition that most of our nutrients, even water, have U-shaped curves.
Right. Even water.
We can poison ourselves with water.
Right.
And cause pontine myelolysis, and end up in the ICU and die. And yes, there are cultures that have survived eating primarily meat, or, you know, in the Arctic, meat and blubbers. Yes. But that the
in the winter.
In the winter, it was a very different kind of food than what many of the carnivores are eating now. But, you know, I am open to saying they may be on to some very interesting new novel ideas. Then please write case reports, case series, so we know who's being helped, what do we have to watch for, and let us do some clinical investigations. And we've talked about that. We've talked about, you know, I'd be happy to write some proposals for them. We'd be happy to assist with writing a case report or a case series. You know, I'm. It would be a tremendous service to their cause.
Yeah, and I think it is really. I think that there is something there because one of the observations I've made, at least clinically, again, no RCT, but just a clinical pattern that I've been able to sort of suss out, is that when you have a therapeutic intervention of something like a carnivore diet, and there can be many mechanisms for why this is, but there does seem to be, at least in the ladies that I've worked with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and maybe this brings me to my next question around metabolomics, but because of the almost no carbohydrate consumption, there does seem to be, and it might be that, it might be, you know, the opportunity to heal the gut, the microbiome, you know, we can kind of get into some of those particulars. But it does seem that a therapeutic intervention, a short delta of a carnivore diet, does seem to really help with symptomatic presentation, like the Hashi's flares that you hear about, like if they're exposed to like gluten, let's say. And so after that, this sort of slow reintroduction of carbohydrates, like from the brassica genus that have, you know, mm-hmm. this is sort of the point that Paul and I, we very politely, you know, acknowledge each other's points, but I do strongly feel that, isothiocyanates or like, you know, sulforaphane, containing compounds are very, very important. For, you know, and we can go there if you want, but like for liver detoxification conjugation specifically, mm-hmm. but also for estrogen metabolism, which seems to also be, when we look at Hashi's, you know, a very direct impact on thyroid metabolism too. So I do think that there's some role there. I don't know if you want to comment on that or.
You know, I think from an evolutionary biology standpoint, primates were eating lots of plants. We gradually started adding more animal proteins into our diet. But we probably have a far more thousands of generations that were eating omnivores, plants, hundreds of different plants in a year, and gradually increasing amounts of animal protein. All of those plants speak to our genes and influence gene expression, influence the NRF2 pathway, the the redox pathways influence our estrogen and testosterone metabolism, influence probably thyroid and cortisol metabolism as well. So I think they're very, very helpful. Might being only carnivore be also helpful? We don't know. We haven't investigated it. We have no data other than some clinical experience that the carnivore people talk about, but don't write up. So I don't know how to address that. I have had carnivore patients come to me who experienced initial benefit and then decline in their health and are now coming back, and we're trying to get them back into a omnivore diet. It's a long transition. It does make me wonder about that U-shaped curve, that there's initial benefit. And I also see vegan, people who go raw vegan get initial benefit, great detox.
Ketogenic, same deal.
Ketogenic, initially great response. And then they begin to not do well. And then they come back to me. And it's hard for them to understand that their dietary approach, which had been so helpful initially, may now be part of the problem.
Right. And then they think, okay, I just got to do keto harder. I got to be more strict with my veganism. I got to do the carnivore thing back to right when I first started it. And then they continue to get worse and worse and worse. And it's almost like a it's like a mind game.
It becomes certainly orthorexia.
Yeah.
And you know, and some people, you know, move on like, okay, I can't help them. But what sometimes helps people understand is when I explain the U-shaped curve for water, mm-hmm. that a nutrient we all know is critical to our existence, water. If we don't have enough, we all know we're going to die. And then when I explain to them, I've taken care of people in the hospital, in ICU, who were going to die because they had a condition that forced them to drink water excessively. and they had too much water in their body, destroying, you know, cataclysmically. So that every compound that we consume has this U-shaped curve. Therefore, for some of us, dietary interventions that are so helpful in the beginning, we're addressing those nutritional depletions that we had accumulated. They got us into the middle of the U where we felt great. And then we now are accumulating nutrients and compounds that are toxic to us. And we're going to have to stop consuming those compounds. We may need to detox from those compounds.
I think you can say that for any hormetic stressor. I could make exercise sound like a death trap if I wanted to. I could say it causes transient changes in thyroid function, sex hormone metabolism. Yes. You could have acute atrial fibrillation and hypertension and even a myocardial infarct. You know, like you can make, it's kind of this AUC that you're talking about. Like there's sort of a not enough is not good. Too much is bad news bears. And we want the Goldilocks, like we want it to be just right. It's like you can say it for fasting and cryotherapy and heat therapy. Absolutely. And, you know, what haven't I mentioned there? Fasting and plant consumption and organ consumption. And like you can say it for all of these things.
That is exactly true. And yeah, actually, I'm very empathetic for that. You know, I ran marathons. I competed in Taekwondo nationally. I'm a former athlete. I believed in being I'm very intense as a person. So I overtrained most of my life, my athletic life. I certainly was guilty of overtraining. And as I was working on my recovery, and I could figure out like I could recover, probably overtrained once again. I bet I would have recovered more rapidly.
And your body's like, you haven't learned yet. I'm going to give you another injury.
Made sure to include value rest, which is I did the training. Yeah. And then as I discovered fasting, got into 3-day fast, 5-day fast, 7-day fast. I would not stop my strength training and my HIIT training. And I finally realized, you know, that is really too much stress on my body. I am 66. So it's like, okay, stress is good, but recovery is also really important.
Yes.
When I was really, I didn't value sleep because I had a lot that I wanted to do in life. So I thought 4 hours was plenty.
I am the same. I was the same. I used to be like, I'll sleep when I'm dead. You know, yeah, like, and also you have songs that say that, you know, you're like, okay, I'll just sleep when I'm dead and I'll, you know, do everything I can in the waking hours of my life.
Little did we know that we were making that dead come sooner.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Do you think that there's a role? I wanted to ask you about blood glucose. You know, we're talking about keto, we're talking about the Walls protocol and fasting, et cetera. Do you think that there's a role or a case to be made for aberrant metabolomics in the progression of autoimmunity? So like blood glucose dysregulation, insulin sensitivity.
Goodness, response. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
So we're presenting a poster about that very issue at the America's Committee on Treatment and Research in MS. So I do think if we look at what are the risk factors that make your disease, and this is for all autoimmune diseases, that make your disease more aggressive, more disabling you more quickly, more resistant to therapy. Having metabolic syndrome will do that. Having any of the risk factors for metabolic syndrome will do that. So elevated glucose, elevated triglycerides, low HDL, bigger belly than your butt, high blood pressure. You have any of those, you're going to have a worse outcome. If you have three of those, you have metabolic syndrome, you're going to have a worse outcome. If you have prediabetes or diabetes, you're going to have a worse outcome. So, and we know the longer you have your autoimmune disease, the more likely you are to accumulate all five of those things. My thinking is that there's probably metabolic pathways that are aberrant in the prodrome to autoimmunity that also increase the risk for all those risk factors for metabolic syndrome. And so, you know, I'm talking to my tribe now that if you have an autoimmunity, I recommend that everyone get a continuous glucose monitor for a month to see where you're at. Measure your belly and your butt, see what your abdominal circumference looks like. Be sure you know your lipids. Be sure you know your blood pressure and address that. Many of us are not as insulin sensitive as we should be. And so, you know, after, you know, wearing my continuous glucose monitor, I'm like, okay, you know, I decreased my starchy vegetable consumption. I leaned heavier on the non-starchies. And if I'm having chocolate, it's total eclipse, 100% chocolate, zero sugar. So it's chocolatey and really quite bitter.
And so you can't have four, fine. You can't have 4 to 10 pieces of it. It's like one suffices, right? When it's that sort of strong and it's
that intense, you're sort of like, okay, this is a meditative experience, you know, and, you know, a lot of people enjoy coffee, which is quite bitter. So the enjoyment of bitter flavors, that's a cultivated taste. And I think there's probably altered physiology that happens in the development of autoimmunity that at the same time is putting you at risk for metabolic disruption as well. So if you have an autoimmune diagnosis, you're at significant risk for having one of the five risk factors for metabolic syndrome and having a lot of surprise in store for you when you put on that continuous glucose monitor. You realize, like, oh, those sweet potato fries shot my glucose up a whole lot more than what I want. So I think I'm going to have kimchi instead.
I think there's value in also, I understand bitter, you know, I grew up having lots of bitter foods. Like I love dandelion, for example, even just like sauteed. And it's, you know, one of those like, oh, throwaway plants, right? It's like, oh, they're weeds. You know, my mother-in-law will literally like go and pick them and then sort of make, you know, saute them with some olive oil and garlic. And it's just like, just very delicious. Very tasty. And then you see all of the sort of xenohormetic effects that it has on in terms of blood pressure and, you know, all the things that that bitters can do. And there's been a lot of discussion around the positive impact that they may have on liver function as well. Let's touch briefly on the microbiome. One of the things I've noticed is that, and again, I'm coming back to Hashimoto's because I know that a little bit more intimately than some of the other autoimmune conditions. One of the things I've noticed is that there's either several of the following. You either have gut dysbiosis, hyperpermeability of the gut, elevated zonulin production, parasitic infection. And I'm going to be sort of like super honest here. Like you can run the stool tests and you can sequence the microbiome and it's not always clear what the path forward is. Like, I feel like it's such a imprecise, you know, maybe infant, like young science.
Very young science.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the microbiome and its role in autoimmunity? And are there sort of best practices, if you will, for helping to heal the microbiome in terms of structure and function?
Well, one of my partners at the university is a microbiome researcher. So he and I have this conversation a lot. We collect poop in our study. So we're going to be writing up our poop discoveries. A couple of things. For billions of years, when we became multicellular, we brought the single cellular and some other multicellular organs into our guts. And they've helped us digest our food, make vitamins, make key nutrients, make neurotransmitters, regulate our immune cells since we've been multicellular. We definitely have a very cooperative relationship with them. And I would, for all everyone says, oh, we've got parasites. Parasites are part of the problem. Well, we also have studies showing that treating with parasites can turn off inflammatory bowel disease, asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, I believe. And there are a variety of parasites that have been used to regulate the immune system, calm it down, and treat autoimmunity. We also know from some really large studies in China and India, when you give large swaths of the population worming medicine, because large swaths of the population in India and China do have parasites, that you had no improvement in health outcomes. So, you know, I think the answer of parasites are uniformly bad, we really don't know that. Parasites might be bad for the person and might need to be treated. Yeah. As that's sort of a case-by-case study. Which microbes are helpful? I doubt that we're going to ever get to know that, at least in the short term. I think a better way of thinking about this is that over millions of generations, we have had mutations in our genome for enzymatic steps that we can no longer do properly. And that happened in my ancestral mommy and in your ancestral mama. But her microbes could still do that step. So at that instant, that enzymatic step disappeared from my genome and got exported to the microbes in my gut. And we've been passing those microbes through the vagina to our children for millions of generations, you know, 200 million years as mammals that we've been doing that. So the question is not which bugs that I have, because the bugs keep swapping their genes around all the time too. So you don't know just because you have that bug, which metabolic functions that bug can necessarily do. What's probably most important is, can the microbiome fill in all the gaps on the metabolic function that have disappeared in my human genome? And to that end, a more diverse microbiome will likely be more capable of filling in the metabolic gaps. And that if you have a healthy liver, all the metabolic gaps and the stuff that my microbiome is making from the food that I eat that get into the portal vein, go to the liver, and my liver will filter out the not helpful compounds. And we'll let the helpful compounds stay in circulation and fill in all the gaps. To that end, a diverse diet gets a more diverse microbiome, more cups of fermented brassica vegetables will get you a more diverse microbiome. A more fermented milk products, if you're consuming milk, and whether those are nut milks, coconut milks, or milks, and I have a lot of mixed feelings about milk. Milk is a superfood, but once you're past fusing your growth plates, I think there's more hazard than benefits. And that mammals—
About 25 years of age is when that happens, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, for 200 million years, mammals have used the superfood breast secretions known as milk to raise our young. And when our young were weaned, they never got milk. It's a recent experiment in humanity that have continued that food. So it's certainly not an essential food. There are aspects of it that make it great. And there are aspects of it that have negative health consequences.
And they also, we don't see calves. You know, you don't see interspecies milk consumption either, right? You don't have calves, baby cows consuming, I don't know, sheep milk,
well,
let's say.
You know, that's true. I grew up on a dairy farm, and every now and then you'd see a cow start chewing on the teats of another cow. And then you separate that relationship and sell one cow off. So that will occasionally happen, but I've never seen a cow go after teats on a different species. I mean,
It doesn't happen.
We see some strange things on the farm, but that definitely is not one.
All right. I want to be respectful of your time. I know that you had mentioned that you're starting a new research project, and I believe it's this is open for enrollment. So if people are looking to, is that
correct?
Correct.
Right. So let me explain. This is the efficacy of diet, quality of life. We have approval. I think we'll be opening up our screening for this. If not at the end of this week, probably next week. You need to have relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. You need to live within 500 miles of Iowa City, Iowa, and you'll get a baseline set of questionnaires, clinical exam, and a brain imaging using an MRI scanner. You'll come back in 3 months for a repeat blood work and clinical exam, and you'll come back at 2 years for repeat clinical exam and MRIs. We'll have questionnaires that are done frequently throughout. We'll have three groups, a ketogenic group, a modified paleo group, and a dietary guidelines group. And this will be the longest dietary intervention study that's been done to date. It will have MRIs, very exciting. It's going to have some blood biomarkers, very exciting. And it's made possible by a philanthropic support from the Chapman Shreve Foundation, which, you know, is actually, you know, so I'm very grateful to them. The university, what really elevated my stay at the university is the fact I've had such remarkable success with philanthropic support to do my pilot studies and now this much larger study. And the university realizes that, you know, I had the success from grateful patients and grateful people whose lives have been transformed by my work.
Beautiful. Well, I will make sure, and I'll get from your assistant, like where people, if they meet those qualifications, where they might sign up for that.
We'll get you the link for that to my research lab. If you go to our research lab, we'll have links for all of the studies that we've got going on.
Okay, great. So I'll make sure that those are in the show notes. Dr. Terry Walls, thank you for your contribution to science. Thank you for being someone who's not easily pushed over and told to sit down and shut up. And thank you for continuing the good fight. I really think that your contribution to our understanding of autoimmunity, as a clinician, I followed you for years, and I think you've made a profound contribution to both my clinical life, but I know many, as I mentioned, many clinicians listen to this. There's going to be many women who are listening to this who know either themselves or they have family members that have been touched by autoimmunity. It's something that we're seeing more and more and more frequently. So thank you for your presence today, your knowledge. And I know that so many of my listeners are going to find this incredibly, incredibly valuable.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.